Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a weekly show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Charles Sorensen, CEO Emeritus of Intermountain Health, an innovative integrated healthcare system based in Salt Lake City, committed to improving access to care, advancing telemedicine and genomics, and improving outcomes while reducing costs. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Charles Sorensen, CEO Emeritus of Intermountain Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Charles Sorensen, President and CEO Emeritus at Intermountain Healthcare, a not-for-profit Salt Lake City-based integrated health system serving patients in Utah and Idaho. Dr. Sorensen served for 8 years as CEO of Intermountain. Prior to that, he spent 10 years as Chief Operating Officer while continuing to perform weekly surgeries in urology. He's the founding director of Intermountain Healthcare's Leadership Institute. Dr. Sorensen earned his BA at the University of Utah and his MD at Cornell Medical School. Dr. Sorensen, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, you served at the helm of a highly regarded health system, one that strives for value and quality through an integrated approach to care delivery. And former President Obama said Intermountain was a health system that should be emulated everywhere in the country, saying it offers high-quality care at below-average cost. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners what's unique about Intermountain's approach.
I think it really comes from our roots. Intermountain was founded in 1975 when the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints decided to donate its 15 community hospitals that it owned to a newly created non-sectarian, not-for-profit health system, which they named Intermountain Healthcare. And since then, Intermountain has been completely independent from the church. But it began with a charge from the founders to the original board to become a model health system. And I've been on the board for 20-plus years and worked with Intermountain for over 40 years. And as a person there on the front line, I really saw that in play. From the first, it was a focus on quality, but it was also a focus really before almost any place else talking about, are these healthcare costs going to be affordable to the community? And what made a difference for us, one is information systems. Dr. Homer Warner, an extraordinarily capable MD, PhD-trained cardiologist, became, by the late 1960s, one of the true pioneers in using computers to track clinical outcomes and to assist in clinical decision-making. And by the early 1980s, we had objective information on clinical outcomes and costs for the majority of the things that we did at Intermountain. That was huge. And then by the later 80s, Dr. Brent James joined us, and he was one of the first people in the world to apply the things that Professor W. Edward Deming had learned about industrial production, adoption of best practices, and elimination of inappropriate variation led in industry to higher quality products at lower production costs. And Brent thought the same could be done at Intermountain. And the reason he came is because we had these data systems that would help us understand what we were really doing. So that combination led to, by the mid-90s, we founded our clinical programs, which focus on implementation of evidence-based best practices across the enterprise. And when we eliminate unwarranted variation, don't do things that just add cost or risk, we get better clinical outcomes at lower overall costs to the community.
Well, Dr. Sorensen, you have a successor as CEO, and that's Dr. Mark Harrison, and he's been continuing really the innovative path, and you've launched one of the nation's largest virtual hospital networks, and we understand you're also creating a drug manufacturing entity to address the high cost of pharmaceuticals, and he has clearly credited you for laying the groundwork that made this innovation possible. Talk with us a little more, if you will, about this culture of innovation at Intermountain and how that is so vital to addressing some of the great challenges in American healthcare.
I think this work at innovation at Intermountain Information Systems, and followed later by the telemedicine and precision genomics, and more recently with our venture with other colleagues around the country into producing generic drugs, it all goes back to the roots of what can we do to provide consistently excellent outcomes for people and do it at affordable cost? Because we realize that healthcare is increasingly unaffordable. And so we've really looked to innovation, technical solutions that both improve care and at minimum don't increase costs, but preferably reduce costs. So when we started a few years ago in telemedicine, the first thing we thought of is how much waste there is in people who have to go to an emergency room, a high-cost venue, for treating something simple like a sore throat or a bladder infection. We do that remotely, and that's led to our telemedicine program for primary care, which we call Connect Care, and that's really growing. And then we've had this network of hospitals throughout Intermountain West here where we can provide support to patients who need consultations in neonatology, critical care, cardiology, where the specialist can be at the bedside virtually with the patient and a local primary care physician. It's been fabulous. We've been able to keep people in their communities, avoid the cost of transport, and get great outcomes. And, you know, all of us have stood by in dismay and have seen the unbelievable unaffordability and unavailability of drugs that have been generic since I was a medical student.
Right.
I'd go out and visit in our primary care clinics, and I asked a group of primary care doctors, I said, what's the biggest problem that's inhibiting you from providing the care that you need to your patients? And one of our pediatricians said, the cost of drugs. And I asked her, I said, well, okay, well, what kind of drugs? Amoxicillin. I said, amoxicillin?
Right.
She said, yeah, it's either not available or it costs so much, and patients on a high-deductible health plan, you can't afford it. Dr. Harrison has really propelled this since he's come here and, as you know, has had other good health systems that have joined us. And we're going to take a swing at making a difference here because we've got a responsibility, and if we can get together and have the size of these health systems help us to be able to produce generic drugs at more affordable price mm-hmm. for the communities we serve, then that's a win for everybody.
Let's talk about one of your most recent ventures. You're the founding director of the Intermountain Healthcare Leadership Institute, which is offering experienced health executives mentorship and training in leadership processes. You've developed at Intermountain at things such as character, personal vision, and ethics, things that can sometimes get lost in the business side of the equation. Talk to us about the genesis of this Leadership Institute and what you hope to achieve.
It started about 7 or 8 years ago, I guess. CEO colleagues around the country asked me, hey, Charles, where are we going to find physicians who have credibility with other clinical people and understand leadership? And I thought we need to develop a different program for training clinical leaders. We aren't selected as medical students or trained through residency in leadership. It's still very much command and control, authority and expert directed, rather than working with a team of diverse skills to a noble purpose and having a team leader who inspires that team, empowers them to give their best. And that's where we really want to focus. And as we were developing that, we ran a couple of cohorts internally, including some great external faculty, including some of the folks at the Harvard Business School who've been really helpful in this process. Some of the people on my team that we were developing that said, we probably ought to focus not just on doctors. How about if we included half the cohort being physician leaders and half being operational administrative leaders, and we can learn from one another? I said, that's great. But we're really focused in our program on that intersection of clinical and operational expertise and focused, as you mentioned, on leaders, because I think healthcare leadership requires real servant leaders, people who have an intense personal drive to fulfill an organization's mission, and somewhat paradoxically, having a deep personal humility and well-managed ego. Those are the kind of people that I think can inspire everybody around them to give their best in an organization. So we really want to focus on emotional intelligence. You know, I've thought, why do we still study people like Washington or Lincoln or Gandhi years after their time has passed? We study them because of their ability to engage people in a noble cause in challenging times. And I think that's what we need in healthcare.
Intermountain recently launched a partnership with Utah Governor Herbert and former HHS Secretary Michael Levitt's group, Levitt Partners, in a quest to address the social determinants of health. Could you talk with us about these efforts at mitigating some of the health problems that populations face and some of the partnerships that you think are required to address the social drivers of poor health, which remains just such a huge challenge to clinicians everywhere?
Yeah, everybody knows that the United States spends about twice as much per capita on healthcare than to most other Western democracies. But as you just mentioned, the social determinants of health just have this gigantic impact on health and healthcare costs. You and your listeners are probably aware of various studies that have been published in the last year or two that track total spending by country on health and social programs combined. And while the United States is the highest on healthcare spending, if you combine social spending and healthcare spending, the United States is really right in the middle of the pack on the total spend. The sad thing about that is by failing to address some of those social determinants, then obviously it's not just about cost. It's about the human suffering that could have been prevented if we address those social determinants. So with great input and support from Governor Levitt and Governor Herbert, that Dr. Harrison is leading our team to see how we can be proactive in addressing some of those social determinants, poverty, lack of access to appropriate care, especially preventive care, help with addiction recovery services, behavioral health issues, and Intermountain will start these initiatives to see if we can't demonstrate that we can make a real difference on the total spend for health care and fulfilling Intermountain's mission of helping people live the healthiest lives possible.
We're speaking today with Dr. Charles Sorensen, President and CEO Emeritus at Intermountain Healthcare, a not-for-profit integrated health system. He's now founding director of the Intermountain Healthcare Leadership Institute. Dr. Sorensen, Intermountain has been trying to develop care delivery systems that promote value, and when your organization sees telemedicine as a highly effective tool, how do you define that suite of opportunities to connect with patients when they need to at distance? Tell us what you're thinking about at Intermountain in this whole area.
We first thought about that as we were under, you know, these big spaces between population centers in the Western United States. How do we get the services of experts to the people who need it in these more remote communities? Because we've always felt that at Intermountain, we want our patients to get the same high-quality service no matter where they present at our Intermountain system. And traditionally, that meant you had to transport people by ground or air to our larger centers when some complication came up. But probably about 8 or 9 years ago, we began to have real success, first in the areas of neonatology and maternal-fetal medicine, where our experts at our major centers and our children's hospital could connect with specialists in our community hospitals that are more remote, being able to see the patient, consult with the physician on site, and even help, say, the pediatrician in a local community do an urgent procedure that needed to be done right there, such as helping him with a little kid who has a pneumothorax put in a chest tube. And we had some rapid returns on that investment in terms of avoiding the cost of transport, so better outcomes, lower time in the hospital. It was really powerful. And obviously the other benefit is we don't have to have busy specialists traveling all around the state, you know, and trying to see people in clinic, because these problems come up real time. It's not like they come up when the
it's convenient,
is scheduled
right
to be there, you know. So building on that, then we started to think about how inconvenient healthcare was for much simpler problems. You know, if, say, a woman starts getting a bladder infection, the traditional way is, okay, I got to leave my job and go wait in the doctor's office. And when you know, if they're not having a fever or flank pain, a straightforward prescription works. And so, you know, doing Connect Care, which is on your mobile device, you can talk to the doctor, you can relate your symptoms, the doctor has access to your electronic medical record. They can say, well, it sounds like we really ought to get you on some antibiotics, but I'd like to get a urine culture. I'm going to send you a thing so you can go get a culture at a nearby Intermountain facility. Now, with both of these situations, actually, what does it do to Intermountain's revenues in the fee-for-service environment? It decreases it. So, I mean, this is another instance where doing the right thing for the patients actually were punished in the fee-for-service environment by having less revenues. But we've been focused since the first, and the board has always supported doing the right thing at Intermountain, even when that reduced our revenues. And that's one of the reasons why I absolutely believe that we are not going to fix the healthcare problems in the United States of quality or cost as long as we're stuck in this fee for service where we get paid based on how much we do, and especially paid to do expensive rescue care, and we get paid almost nothing to prevent problems, you know. So we can move to population-based payments, so we can use our resources and our experts to address things on the front end and still be the very best by following evidence-based best practices and doing that at an affordable cost. But we got to move that direction.
Well, Dr. Sorensen, in all of your many years of leadership and administration, I understand that you've continued your clinical practice in urology and surgery, and you had a front row seat on changes in the acute care setting, but there's also been a lot of cultural changes, the movement towards more of a interdisciplinary team-based model, the focus on safety, the rise of advanced practice providers, PAs and nurse practitioners in the acute care setting. And I'm really curious, what do you make of all the changes and the degree to which those things have moved things forward in a positive way?
I love it. I was never looking for a move to an administrative position because I loved being in the clinical settings. I loved working with our team in the operating room, with our team in the clinic, with other fabulous professional colleagues in all specialties taking care of really sick patients. And I always, that team was part of my family. I mean, just people who you totally trust and with my own life. And so, you know, I'd been involved in helping found the Intermountain Medical Group and on the board and stuff like that, but never looking for an administrative position. And when they asked me if I'd take one, I really didn't want to. And a lot of it was I just didn't want to leave those teams. But ultimately, I thought, well, if I think we need to have doctors involved in making decisions and then none of us are willing to do it, then shame on me. So I did it, but I said, I just can't give up being with the team. It's just such an important thing for me because it builds camaraderie with people where you can measure your outcomes and get better together and learn from things that didn't go so well. And so I totally and enthusiastically embrace this movement to team-based care. And not only for specialties, but even for primary care. My dad was an internist, and he was such a dedicated doctor. But I also saw how lonely it could be being just a doctor, even in a clinic where you're taking care of your own patients, but you don't have the team, the whole team there. Now with increasingly complex patients, it can just be overwhelming for an internist, say, to be confronting an elderly patient who's got social problems, maybe has depression, has diabetes, and to that doctor to try to do that all by herself is oppressive. But when you have a team that comes together and she, as the lead of that team, can make the medical decisions and then have experts on the team that help address the social determinants, the behavioral health monitoring, I think this not only reduces the chance of error, but I think it dramatically can reduce clinician burnout.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Charles Sorensen, founding director of Intermountain Healthcare's Leadership Institute and president and CEO emeritus at Intermountain Healthcare. You can learn more about their innovative approach to care delivery by going to intermountainhealthcare.org. Or you can follow them on Twitter at Intermountain. Dr. Sorensen, thank you for your team-based leadership and for joining us in Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor to be with you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Beginning January 1st, Medicare Advantage enrollees may be required to use lower-cost alternatives to more expensive drugs for new prescriptions for medications administered in a clinical setting. Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar has described the new policy as, quote, unleashing our Medicare Advantage plans to negotiate discounting on $12 billion of drugs. Some patient advocacy groups, meanwhile, have described the policy as one that, quote, could erect barriers to care for cancer. Step therapy is a practice of requiring patients to take less expensive or preferred alternatives to certain medications before moving on to the more costly options or the drugs prescribed by physicians if the original treatments aren't effective for the patient. An August memo from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said Medicare Advantage plans could use step therapy for Part B drugs next year. Part B drugs are those administered by a physician or in a clinical setting. The CMS policy would only apply to new prescriptions. Beneficiaries already receiving Part B medications won't be affected. Drug manufacturers of the more expensive remedies could lower their prices so that they don't lose business to the lower cost alternatives. Experts we consulted said the impact could be small. There are about 20 million people with Medicare Advantage plans. That's one-third of all Medicare enrollees, and Medicare Advantage plans spent about $12 billion per year on Part B drugs. But savings would depend on how many Medicare Advantage plans decide to use step therapy and how many drug therapies can be subject to the policy. As for barriers to care, the Department of Health and Human Services says there is an appeals process. Enrollees can request an exception from their plan to get medication without first trying an alternative. And those requests will generally be reviewed within 72 hours. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children, since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shule stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
I've made this Google Maps mashup. If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map.
So he founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers in upwards of 40 countries around the world, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
We know that we've delivered about 800 hands devices, and we suspect that a comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
These things grip or ungrip. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge. You know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands, and for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking to makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world who might otherwise not be able to afford them. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.